Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Robbie Robertson and the Red Road Ensemble, Music for the Native Americans, Mach G, or the Heartbeat Drum Song. December 1st is World AIDS Day, and we'll talk today with Josh Ruxin, the director of Access Project for the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria at the Center for Global Health and Economic Development at Columbia University. And today we'll also begin an ongoing series about indigenous people around the world. The series starts with the San Francisco Bay Area native people, the Ohlone. Naturalist Beverly Ortiz will discuss local customs and languages. And yes, that is plural, as there were many, many languages spoken right here in the Bay Area. First, regular listeners to Raising Sand Radio know that we keep you up to date on the ongoing global campaign against cluster bombs. This campaign received a major boost in New York in October during the UN First Committee on Disarmament and International Security. One new signature and two new ratifications brought the Convention on Cluster Munitions up to 103 signatures and 24 ratifications. 30 ratifications are required for the convention to enter into force and become binding international law. Only when the convention enters into force will states be bound by all of the convention's terms and deadlines and start the countdown for the clearance of contaminated land and the destruction of the remaining stockpiles. The Convention on Cluster Munitions is challenging all states to ratify the convention without delay and to strive to be among the first 30 states responsible for triggering the convention into force. You can go to stopclustermunitions.org to learn more, stopclustermunitions.org, or to find out how to urge your government to sign if it has not already done so. And if you're an American in the United States, we are one of the holdouts. Other holdouts include the biggest makers and users of cluster bombs besides the United States, Russia, China, Israel, India, and Pakistan. Back in May last year in Dublin, Ireland, when diplomats from 111 nations formally adopted the landmark treaty banning cluster bombs, State Department spokesman Tom Casey said the United States remained committed to United Nations-sponsored talks that seek voluntary codes of, quote, best practices among leading makers of cluster bombs. Well, let's hope that the Obama administration will do better than it did just last week on November 25th when it announced that it would not be joining the treaty signed by 158 other countries to ban landmines. Human Rights Watch said the decision lacks vision, compassion, and basic common sense, unquote. A spokesman said that this review must have been done without consulting experts outside the administration, organizations working on the issues, or lawmakers that have been dealing with the landmine concerns for years, like Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy. Quote, the Obama administration's decision to continue the Bush administration's policy of refusing to join the international treaty banning anti-personnel landmines is a reprehensible rejection of the most successful disarmament and humanitarian treaty of the past decade, unquote. Human Rights Watch noted that foreign allies were apparently not consulted either, adding that the 1997 treaty has already been endorsed by nearly every U.S. military ally. December 1st is World AIDS Day. According to new data in a 2009 AIDS epidemic update, new HIV infections have been reduced by 17% over the past 8 years. Since 2001, when the United Nations Declaration of Commitment on HIV/AIDS was signed, the number of new infections in sub-Saharan Africa is approximately 15% lower, which is about 400,000 fewer infections in 2008. However, in some countries, there are signs that new HIV infections are rising again. Some quick numbers. 33.4 million people are living with HIV worldwide. 2.7 million people approximately were newly infected in 2008. And 2 million people died of AIDS-related illness in 2008. I want to welcome Josh Ruxin, director of the Access Project for the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria
at the Center for Global Health and Economic Development at Columbia University. Welcome, Josh Ruxin.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you. In fact, I want our listeners to know that we're talking via Skype and you are in Kigali, Rwanda. So this is the first time we've talked with anyone in Rwanda, and this is a good topic to be breaking into that new area with. Thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
So you're also the country director for the new Millennium Village Project in Kigali, Rwanda, and you live there, and there you focus on comprehensive approaches to fighting poverty with an emphasis on scaling up national health programs. How does your work with HIV/AIDS mesh with this work in Kigali?
Well, one of the reasons I decided to move to Rwanda was actually that the Rwandan government takes a much more integrated approach to thinking about HIV/AIDS than many other African governments, and in part as a result of that integrated approach, and also as a result of the fact that prevalence here tends to be much lower than some countries in sub-Saharan Africa. In Rwanda, it's estimated that about 3% of all adults are HIV positive. It is a place where you can actually get traction and get the work done. So for me, there's not really a disconnection between the work I do here on HIV/AIDS and general poverty reduction and prosperity creation. It's all part of the same development paradigm.
And do you work with other countries in sub-Saharan Africa also, based on your experiences in Kigali?
I do. I've worked in over a dozen countries in sub-Saharan Africa, but really the focus for me these days is on Rwanda. I also do some work in Ethiopia as well.
Mm-hmm. And you sometimes work with the AIDS epidemic in South Africa.
Well, through my work with the Access Project, our goal is really to help countries access the Global Fund. And the Global Fund, some of your listeners might be aware, is really one of the most robust and vibrant financial mechanisms for getting dollars to countries that are fighting this horrible pandemic. And so in that capacity, I've actually done quite a bit of work with South Africa. I'm actually heading down there in just the next couple of weeks.
Josh Ruxin, you've written AIDS is now estimated to have emerged in Central Africa in the 1940s. And as an epidemiological forensics improve, that day may roll back substantially. Through the 1960s and 70s, a deadly slimming disease destroyed swaths of humanity long before hitting our radar screens in the early 1980s. Talk about that.
Well, I think one of the surprising things to hear is that AIDS is not just a disease that started in the U.S. the way a lot of people think about it in the early 1980s, when, of course, it hit the gay community in the States. The current view is that AIDS originated in Central Africa, certainly 50, 60 years ago, and there are people out there who think that it might have been out there a century or more ago, and that data is, of course, slowly coming to the fore. And, you know, one of the most interesting things about that and sad things is to think there was this terrible destructive storm going on in Central Africa. But before we had good surveillance systems, before we had real development programs in Central Africa, it was something that we didn't know about. And I think that says a lot about how little we have actually done as far as development is concerned in public health in Central Africa in, say, the 1970s and 80s, because if we'd been doing a good job of it, we might have picked up on this emerging epidemic much, much sooner. And, you know, one of the lessons of SARS and of avian flu, and certainly the flu that we're all taking a look at right now, is that you have to have great surveillance, especially at the sites where there are lots of people who don't currently have access to healthcare and who might have lots of interaction with other species, whether they be primates or, you know, other types of animals that might be used for bushmeat. Mm-hmm. And that's really today the epicenter of a lot of interesting work in epidemiology to figure out, well, where did AIDS come from and where's the next virus going to come from?
Mm-hmm. AIDS has also been a very political issue, though, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think in my view, AIDS is really the toughest disease humanity's ever faced because it really hits our sweet spots. People don't like to talk about sex publicly in general anyway. In lots of the world, it's virtually impossible to have conversations about sex and what people's behaviors are. And so on that front, it's a really striking disease. From the standpoint of how long it takes for someone to get sick, which on average is some 6 to 10 years, that also makes it very tough. People are used to getting a virus, like the cold virus I happen to have right now, in an incubation period of, say, 48 hours to maybe a week. But when you tell people, well, you're actually sick, you're carrying a virus that will one day potentially kill you, but you're going to feel fine for the next several years, that's a really hard message to get through. So in all these respects, and probably finally the political respect, which is that traditionally politics in sub-Saharan Africa have not been very inclusive of global health or generally poverty reduction issues overall, this is a disease that really destroys us where it hurts the most. Mm-hmm. And when I say where it hurts the most, if you take a look at South Africa, I'm talking about a country where, you know, between a third and a quarter of the entire adult population is HIV positive. And if they don't get cured, and of course we don't have a cure currently, but if they don't get treated during the next few years, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who are dying in a relatively small country every single year.
And we're going to talk a little more about the fallout from that. But I wanted to mention that in South Africa, the ANC is planning a post-election apology to the nation. Now, I don't know if they've actually done this. Maybe you do. But they were going to apologize to the nation for former President Thabo Mbeki's disastrous HIV/AIDS policy, which has been blamed for the death of thousands of infected people, according to this is the report in the New York Times. And an ANC MP said, "We owe it to the nation. We as MPs were there and we failed to rise up." This notion of denialism is huge in South Africa. Can you talk a little bit about Mbeki's whole policy?
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about it. I'm going to be a little bit more provocative in my response, though, and say, you know, everyone's looking at Mbeki and there is no question there is blood on that man's hands. And it's not just the blood of South Africans, it's the blood of a continent, because other countries looked to South Africa for leadership to fight HIV/AIDS. And when they saw what Mbeki was doing, which was absolutely nothing, which was denying, in fact, the link between HIV, the virus, and AIDS, the symptoms of having that virus at high levels in one's bloodstream, He really brought down the continent and allowed the entire disease to flourish. But, you know, it's interesting. People don't look back at just the post-apartheid history, and in particular at Mandela. There were plenty of people who were encouraging Mandela at the time that he became president to really step up and take a real leadership role. But he, too, has confessed and said, well, you know, this wasn't something I wanted to take on with this new nation, didn't want to tell people what to do when they were so used to being told what to do for decades, centuries. So, you know, there's a very troubling political history when it comes to HIV/AIDS in South Africa and a real failure of leadership across all levels. And Mbeki just happened to be the very worst combination across all these dimensions.
And as you say, Mandela chose not to do it also. And there's a little bit of a bubbling up in South Africa about that. In fact, the Communist Youth League in South Africa is surfacing this notion that Mbeki should be charged with genocide because of his position.
Yeah, I mean, of course, living in a country which has gone through a real genocide, it's a bit absurd to think of charging him with that. Certainly charging him with gross improprieties and a failure to act as a nation's leader when a disease was decimating the population, and to not rely on the scientific guidance, which was very much out there in front of him, you know, on all those charges, absolutely guilty, calling it genocide, of course, is an inappropriate application of the terminology.
Since you're based in Africa, let's talk about the different approaches in a developing nation to the way that we approach it here in the United States. Can you make some comparisons?
Well, yeah, I think there are a lot of comparisons to be made. I mean, first of all, just across Africa, because of all the funding that's come in through the Global Fund and also from the U.S. government and other bilaterals and multilaterals over the past 10 years, AIDS is much more on people's radar screen. It's something that's talked about more. It's something that's on the radio more. It's something that people are much more conscious of than, say, in the States.
This is Susan Gallimore, host of Raising Sand Radio, talking with Josh Ruxin, who is in Rwanda. We're talking via Skype, so the audio may be a little off, but it's great to have you with us. We're doing a general comparison between developing countries and a country like the United States, different ways of handling AIDS and complications of being in a developing nation.
Here in Rwanda, I mean, one of the remarkable aspects of being in a country which is actually taking the fight against AIDS seriously is that Rwanda has remarkably delivered the antiretroviral treatment and the care and prevention programs that are desperately needed in order to stanch the epidemic here. And that's one of the reasons that the prevalence rate is quite low. I also say that, you know, the U.S. government and the Global Fund deserve great kudos for the hundreds of millions of dollars that they've plowed into the efforts here. AIDS certainly looks different across Africa. I mean, AIDS is sort of the alarming, catastrophic public health disaster that the only comparison to it in contemporary times in the state is really H1N1, where we've been talking about a flu which has impacted millions and really raised the alarm about the public's health. That is what it's like to be just about in any country in sub-Saharan Africa today when it comes to AIDS. It is an ongoing emergency. There are people dying. There are millions of people dying. Most people who die on the planet every year from AIDS, over 1.5 million, die in sub-Saharan Africa. This is the very center of this global pandemic, and we don't yet have good enough tools to deploy to squash it. We do have some very good tools that have not been applied to the degree that they should, in part because of ideology trumping real science. And that certainly applies in South Africa, and it also applies to U.S. government policy over the last 8 years or so.
Now, a country like Uganda had a tremendously high AIDS rate at one point, and then they fought it. What's the situation with Uganda right now?
Well, Uganda is one of those countries where I've never quite trusted all of the data, and I certainly have never trusted the conclusions, because, you know, Uganda was the country that was cited by the Bush administration as having so effectively deployed the Bush administration's policy of abstinence, being faithful, and then, if you must, using condoms. You know, they said, well, this worked so effectively in Uganda, it brought down the overall rate of prevalence, which means how many people in the population actually suffer from the disease or are carrying the virus. But one of the things that they always neglected to mention was that the prevalence rate was dropping before we did anything because so many people were dying. The only way to really reduce the prevalence rate is either lots more people are born, thus your population is higher, or people die from the disease, in which case you've got fewer of them carrying them. So I think Uganda did have some progress, but right now what's coming back to haunt everyone is the realization that the data was really overblown, that they have not launched an effective response, that AIDS is still spreading at an alarming rate there, and this is tied to all sorts of other issues, issues of family planning, the use of condoms, and general corruption in that country. That's one of the countries, for example, that lost Global Fund financing because of corruption. So it is certainly not the success story that it's been touted as. I really find, you know, the most successful stories across Africa are probably Rwanda and Botswana, countries with much different epidemics, but both of which have made enormous strides forward.
Talk a little bit about Botswana. What's happening there?
Well, Botswana is the country in the world with really the most concentrated epidemic, something around 40% of the adult population infected. I mean, that's just such a staggering number. Nearly every other person you bump into is HIV positive. But Botswana has resources. Botswana is organized and they have good management. And so starting nearly a decade ago, decided to launch a real comprehensive response. And they've been very effective in getting people onto antiretroviral therapy, in promoting prevention to stop the epidemic from spreading anymore. And today, their death rate from HIV/AIDS is falling quite substantially.
Let's talk about the impact on families. I actually grew up in KwaZulu-Natal, and I will be back there next month, and we'll be doing a lot more shows on the local impact of HIV/AIDS. But one of the things that's happening, certainly in that region, is that parents are dying and families are being left or orphaned, and in some cases, young kids are having to take care of one another. And the country, of course, is so overwhelmed with their economic problems that there's not a lot of support for these young kids. And some of them, of course, are having to turn to prostitution. There's a whole mindset around the use of condoms in that country. And so the epidemic is continuing in those new areas. Can you talk about the impact of this on the families, on the social scene, and what that means?
Well, what you're hitting on, I think, is one of the most terrifying aspects of this global pandemic, which is people who've realized that at least as identified, AIDS has been on the planet since 1982, 83. We are still very much in perhaps the middle of the beginning of the pandemic. And the data coming out from WHO UNAIDS should not cause anyone to feel comfortable about what's happening because, as you point out, in KZN and other places in sub-Saharan Africa, this virus is destroying communities, it's destroying the fabric of society, it's tearing apart families. And worse yet, when it destroys, it actually improves the ground for cultivating the next wave of the epidemic. So when children see their parents die from HIV/AIDS and they have no economic opportunity and their governments are unable to ensure their education and their social support and their communities cannot do the same, they turn to sex work. Or if not sex work specifically, perhaps more dangerous sexual relationships, which somehow give them other benefits, sometimes school fees, for example. This is a major issue in Uganda among university educated students, young women in particular. And so the seeds are sown for the continuation of this virus. And, you know, this is really the reason, Susan, that when we talk about this pandemic, yes, there are lots of things that we can be doing today, pushing for prevention and pushing out treatment. But as long as AIDS is going to be on this planet, we're going to have to be working towards two things which we currently do not have. One, a cure, and two, an effective vaccine. Because it seems very unlikely that we're going to be able to get everyone on the planet tonight to start using condoms consistently, even though that would shunt the entire spread of HIV.
Well, one of the things that I felt was happening in South Africa early on was that they really just didn't have the money to spend on the medicines that they needed and the treatments that were required because the treatments were so expensive. Is that
Well,
inaccurate?
so a couple of thoughts here. The cost of treatment just going back 7 or 8 years ago was well in excess of $10,000 for effective first-line HIV treatment. And through the work of the Clinton Foundation and a lot of other organizations, as well as the rise in global demand, the drug manufacturers have brought that price down to well below $100 today, something that everyone said would be impossible. Now, the question is there financial support in some of the poorest countries to pay roughly $100 for drugs, plus have the management systems in place to track people living with HIV/AIDS and to follow up with treatment. And the answer is that that does become quite expensive in countries like, say, Ethiopia, which are spending literally perhaps a couple dollars per year per capita on public health. You go from a couple dollars to a few hundred dollars for people living with HIV/AIDS, and it's such a dramatic leap that the public health system that they have in place cannot afford it. And so that's where the Global Fund comes in, and that's where donors come in order to take up that slack and really pay for that. And one thing that can accurately be said today is that any country with a good, competent plan that is poor can turn to other nations and multilaterals and bilaterals and receive the help that they need. But countries that are not terribly democratic, that are not transparent, that have high levels of corruption, are going to have a harder time getting the funding that they need in order to save their people.
Josh Ruxin, what else should people know about this pandemic?
Well, I think that the most important thing to recognize is that while this has sort of faded in the United States of America to be more of, and in Europe as well, to be more of a chronic disease, to be thought of sometimes in the same breath as, say, diabetes or a coronary heart disease, for much of the world, this remains a horrible killer. In spite of what the UN agencies might tell us on this World AIDS Day coming up on December 1st, one thing that is quite clear is that this is a disease that is killing millions, is destroying tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of families, and is continuing to tear apart countries from their very core. And we need to be cognizant of this, and we need to demand that our leaders, particularly in the U.S. government, at USAID and CDC and all these different agencies that are pumping billions of dollars into work to combat the pandemic, that they heed this and continue to do not less, but to do more, because we are very, very far from beginning to make a real impact on this global pandemic.
And what about ways to learn more? Do you have websites that you particularly like to use or institutions that you recommend?
Well, I'd certainly take the opportunity to ask your listeners to check out a website of the project that I actually run here in Rwanda. It's www.theaccessproject.com. We actually tackle HIV/AIDS from a very different angle. We believe that because the money is here for the drugs, what's most important is to make sure that the health centers, these close-to-client care services, are actually provided. The management of the health centers needs to be dramatically improved. So we're actually focused on that. So we've got some interesting stories and some interesting video on our website. I think just as a site to check out for the statistics and how the world is really doing, a terrific organization is AVERT. And they can be found at www.avert.org.
AVERT. There's also worldaidsday.org, just for general information about what's going on around the country for December 1st. It's been great to have you with us, Josh Ruxin. Thank you so much.
Terrific. Thanks so much for having me on the show, Susan.
Now, lest you think that the U.S. has the answers and is on the right track to combat HIV/AIDS, in May of this year, a controversial film premiered at the Nashville Film Festival. The film was called House of Numbers, and it bills itself as an AIDS film like no other. Since Nashville filmmaker Brent Leung's House of Numbers was at Nashville Film Festival, you'd think the film received a unanimously positive reception. However, there is a controversy, and it boils down to this. Leung portrays his film as an unbiased look at HIV and AIDS, while his detractors, including many highly respected AIDS researchers, claim the film is full of misinformation and clearly reflects the filmmaker's AIDS denialist agenda, a contention further fueled by Leung's refusal to identify the film's financial backers. House of Numbers musters an array of people to suggest that HIV/AIDS research is at best riddled with unresolved differences in testing and treatment in causes in the disease's very definition, and at worst a sinister tool of pharmaceutical conglomerates whose cures are perhaps even worse than the cause. quote, doesn't just put the information out there, says Joseph Interante, CEO of the AIDS service organization Nashville Cares. He successfully packages the information to support a presupposed conclusion. Now, Cares put out a statement about this movie because apparently some of these Cares people are quoted frequently in this movie, and they say, "We are writing to state our strong objections to House of Numbers and the agendas it promotes. We consider the film as being harmful to the best interest of the general public, and in particular, people with HIV infection or at risk for acquiring it. We all appear in the film, having granted interviews to its director, Mr. Brent Leung, during the period 2006 through 2008. Mr. Leung was deceptive in his interactions with us. He informed us that his film was intended to present the true history of AIDS research and an accurate summary of the science of HIV infection. He also told several of us that he intended the film would expose and counter many of the myths about HIV and AIDS that have been promoted by a small clique of individuals we refer to as the AIDS denialists. The reality is that his film does none of those things. Instead, it presents the AIDS denialist agenda as being a legitimate scientific perspective on HIV/AIDS when it is no such thing. His film perpetuates pseudoscience and myths." I've lived in the San Francisco Bay Area for 30 years, and during that time I've learned snippets about the indigenous people of the region, much of it, as it turns out, incorrect or outdated. Today we begin an ongoing series of shows that will highlight indigenous people. We start with the native people of the San Francisco Bay Area, the Ohlone. Beverly Ortiz is a naturalist with the East Bay Regional Park District. She is based at Coyote Hills Regional Park, one of the parks in California where non-native people can begin a journey of discovery on just who are the Ohlone people. In this first segment, dealing with the Ohlone people, Beverly Ortiz discusses the languages and customs associated with the area and touches on the early mission influence. Subsequent segments will discuss the loss of traditional lands, land grants, and the apprenticeship programs imposed upon Native people. We just begin that today, but we do not go into it much more than that. I recorded these shows in November, and I asked Beverly Ortiz how many indigenous people from the area that we now call San Francisco Bay Area still live in these parts.
There are perhaps about 5,000 people today who have Ohlone heritage. Most live still in the Bay Area, but many live all over the United States as well as in other countries today. So the Ohlone are very much still here. California, according to the most recent federal census in the year 2000, has the largest population of American Indians of any state in the United States today. Now, the censuses undercount ethnic groups, but if you look at California Native people as a whole, we have the largest population according to the census. And of that, indigenous people of Native California heritage are relatively small in number, and within that then, Ohlone people are relatively small in number. But if you went back more than 200 years, say 250 years before the first non-Indians began to come, intrude, or whatever word, depending on people's perspective they would use, there were about 58 independent tribes of people between the places now known as Richmond and San Francisco, going south of San Juan Bautista and inland toward the San Luis Reservoir, who are now grouped together under the single name Ohlone. The most likely origin of the word Ohlone is the word Oljon, O-L-J-O-N, pronounced with Spanish vowel and consonant pronunciation, because it was the Spanish who first wrote down the tribal names. So we'll never know exactly how those names were pronounced in the indigenous languages. But on the bay shore, inland of the Santa Clara Valley, there was a tribe, the Olhone, and Ohlone seems to have derived from an anglicization of that word. When I say about 58 tribes, the way we know about the various tribes in terms of the written record begins with Spanish documents, because they were the first non-Indians to permanently settle in the Bay Area. So the first mission in the Bay Area was in 1770 in Monterey. And in 1776, the same year that on the other side of the United States, 13 colonies were becoming the beginnings of the United States, Mission Dolores in San Francisco was established. So what anthropologists did at the beginning at the turn of the last century, as they tried to make sense as outsiders of the cultural diversity that was and continues to be Native California, California Indians, is they looked at patterned similarities in the cultures and how closely related the languages people spoke were. And so they created what I think is best called a sense of a cultural nationality of people, who as independent tribal people were close enough in the languages that they spoke perhaps and in their overall cultures to be grouped under a single name. However, that's an outsider's concept. Outsiders tend to look for what's similar, but if you're an insider, what defines who you are is how you're different. So Ohlone peoples didn't even speak a single language, and now you understand why I say peoples, to emphasize that Ohlone is a grouping term. Mm-hmm. In terms of grouping terms, there are also some contemporary Ohlone who still use the grouping term Costanoan, which derives from a Spanish word costaño, which approximately means people of the coast. So it's an anglicization of that word. For many of the independent tribes of Ohlone people who are the contemporary Ohlones from those tribes, because of that association with the Spanish, it has a pejorative sense to it, a negative sense to it. But there are some descendants for whom Ohlone is a word they grew up with. So today, what people would prefer is to be known by their tribal names. Sometimes, because people only know the word Ohlone or Costanoan, you'll say Mutsin Ohlone, Rumsin Ohlone, whatever it is. But many of the contemporary people of the various Ohlone tribes would ultimately wish that they would be known by their specific tribal identities.
I also hear a lot of people say the Miwok were the native people here.
Miwok is a grouping term too. And there's several Miwok grouping terms depending on the area.
Okay.
So the Bay Area grouping term is Bay Miwok. And that refers to seven independent tribes who were largely but not completely in the Contra Costa County area in the Diablo Valley. So you have the Hulpun of the Brentwood Byron area. You have the Totcon of the Danville area, the Volvone of the Clayton area. And in fact, one of the earliest names for Mount Diablo was Sierra de los Bulbones, high point of the Volvone people.
You're listening to Raising Sand Radio at KZSU FM 90.1. I'm Susan Gallimore, talking with Beverly Ortiz, a naturalist with the East Bay Regional Park District. As I mentioned earlier, this is the first of a series of shows Raising Sand Radio will do about Indigenous people around the world, and today we're focusing on the Ohlone tribes of the San Francisco Bay Area. Beverly Ortiz, what do we know about the languages spoken in the region?
When people were beginning to record the languages, and you can actually tell from female name endings language relationships too, in the old time names. There were a few, even in the Spanish time, there was one man in particular, De La Cuesta, who was a priest, and he started making word lists. Now, often the word lists were the tribe most closely associated with the mission, because the mission was in their specific ancestral territory. And so it's a little skewed, but basically three of these languages have been preserved because in the 1920s and 30s, a linguist named J.P. Harrington recorded them. And in fact, there are Ohlones from those linguistic areas who are restoring their languages. There's members of a contemporary Ohlone tribe, the Muwekma, who have a language program around the Chechenya language. There's people from the Mutsin tribe who are restoring their Mutsin language. And then there are individuals like Linda Yamani of Rumsean heritage who are restoring their language. And in the case of the Mutsin and the Rumsean, the language name is the same as the tribal name, whereas Chechenyu is a language name but not a tribal name.
So Chechenyu would be kind of the area that I live in, which is Alameda. That would be the language more likely spoken around there.
Right, although it's slightly more complicated. In this area, there was so much impact so early on people, so much disruption and cultural upheaval and sadness and tragedy, that we don't have as strong a record of all of the languages within the area now grouped as Ohlone. But Randy Milliken, he is an ethnohistorian, a culturally based historian who has done a lot of the work with the unpublished documents, looking at female name endings.
And they would be female because it'd be matrilineal societies.
No, it's just that female name endings are very characteristic in terms of language relationships.
I see. In
the old time names, Randy figured that out. There's language, of course, in the male names too, but apparently the language relationships show up strongest in the female names as endings, as I understand it.
I'm Susan Gallimore, host of Raising Sand Radio at KZSU FM 90.1, talking with Beverly Ortiz, a naturalist with the East Bay Regional Park District. I asked Beverly to define language dialects.
The people who are restoring the languages don't see them as dialects. They believe there's more of a difference than that. Dialects would be, say, the difference between British English and American English. And so they're thinking that their languages were a little more different. Randy thinks, based on personal name endings, that if someone were in, say, Richmond, of course, that area wasn't called that 250 years ago, and they started walking south, and they headed through Oakland, and they got to Alameda area. Of course, a lot of Alameda is landfill, but the parts of Alameda that are old, and they kept going till they reached the most southerly area, and they had a good mind for language. They would see a gradual shifting of the languages from north, to south, such that it was more like a cline of languages that gradually changed as you went from tribe to tribe. And because we don't have all of those records, we don't see the change anymore. We see the differences. No matter whose idea on the language relationships you take, in the distant past, these languages all had a common root. Now, Ohlone is a cultural nationality, a grouping term often referred to as a tribe, but there never was a single Ohlone tribe. What these grouping terms that anthropologists created signify can vary. So if you went up into the area that today is grouped under the name Pomo,
which tends to be up in the Marin County area, northern part of the bay.
Actually, southern Sonoma County, Marin County would be Coast Miwok, another Miwok-speaking group with language relationships to the Bay Miwok in the Diablo Valley area.
Okay.
So there were about 14 independent Coast Miwok tribes. There were about 72 independent Pomo tribes, but because they were less impacted as less early on, the Coast Miwok also were impacted by the mission system, then the Mexican land grant system, and then the system that Americans had, which began with what they called the Apprenticeship Acts, but it was really a system of slave labor for Native people. So further north in the Pomo, where we have a much stronger linguistic record because there were multilingual elders who were interviewed by linguists there, it appears that there were seven mutually unintelligible languages spoken, although those languages have a common root in the way back past relationship. So my point in bringing that up is even what these grouping terms signify in terms of broad-based cultural similarities and broad-based language relationships can vary. So it's a much more broad system. In some cases, when you look at the mission registers, which is where we have to go to trace family lineages to begin with, there were some groups of people who were so bilingual in those name endings, they're so heavily intermarried that you don't see any clear tendency towards one language group or another language group. There's two or three such groups that you can't say are either Bay Miwok or Ohlone. And there's several descendants from one of those groups. In fact, probably more than, well over 100 descendants, because there were eight siblings that now have descendants. And that is the Halkeen. And the Halkeen were a bilingual Bay Miwok Ohlone speaking group.
How many people are we talking about in this area, not divided linguistically, but
approximately 10,000 to 15,000 people 250 years ago is what Randy estimates.
10,000 to 15,000
in all of what you might call Ohlone country. Although there was no such thing as an Ohlone country 250 years ago. It was the individualized territory of the tribes. Now the reason I want to nuance this a little bit, and I know it's confusing, and if there's an audience listening to them, it'll be likewise confusing. But when I say so bilingual, so intermarried, that they can't be put in either of the grouping terms easily, that goes beyond the 58 groups I'm talking about. Now, two of those groups, it's a little bit hard to distinguish whether the Spanish were naming a village or naming a tribal group. So it could turn out that it's 56, but Randy thinks, based on what we know today, that it's that they were tribes and not village names, and that's where the number 58 comes up.
If you are just tuning in, this is FM 90.1 Raising San Radio with Susan Gallimore and Beverly Ortiz, a naturalist with the East Bay Regional Park Districts. She's based at the Coyote Hills Regional Park. Again, this is the first of an ongoing series of Native people, today focusing on the languages and tribal groupings of the San Francisco Bay Area people known as the Ohlone. I asked Beverly Ortiz to describe the physical arrangement, that is, how land was identified with a particular group of people or tribe.
Every tribe had some 8 to 12 square miles of land that was distinctly within their purview. And they had some 3 to 5 villages with leaders who had close kinship ties to the other members of the tribe, and in particular, the members of the village they were from, okay? Defined leaders. Now, tribal groups intermarried across tribal boundaries and across language boundaries. Language wasn't a barrier in the United States today. There's a lot of multilingualism, but most people, the norm tends to be monolingual, unlike other parts of the world. But back 250 years ago, it would not have been unusual to know 7 or 8 languages, including, say, a Bay Miwok language and 2 or 3 Ohlone languages and maybe a Yokuts language. And then when the Spanish intruded, to learn Spanish. Knowing at least 2 languages was a norm. So language wasn't a barrier to either communication or interaction. And so in Ohlone areas, there were some groups that traced their ancestry through the female line, that's being matrilineal, like you suggested earlier. But in the Ohlone areas, we're looking at patrilineal people who traced through the father's line. Now, why this is important to understand as an overview, because people intermarried across language boundaries, but then there would be rules about where the wife or the husband went to live. And it appears in this case that the wife would go to live with the husband's people, and then the children would be raised as members of that tribe. So that's how you keep a tribal identity while also marrying across tribal boundaries and even across linguistic boundaries, and you keep a sense of cohesion and a sense of interconnection. Does this mean that these were idyllic societies and that they always got along and that disputes didn't rise to the level where people were not sometimes killed? No. They're every bit as human as anybody else in the world and capable of all of the good things and all of the bad things that whole human beings are capable of. But what it did do is it brought a larger intertribal cohesion, which allowed for disputes to be often handled, not always handled, on a much lower level, both within tribes and among tribes. And that was one of the things that was so divisive when the mission system was established, was, and of course the most powerful weapon that the missionaries had was germs, disease. Diseases took your young, who were your future, and your old, who were your knowledge bearers. Contrary to popular assumption, not everyone in the tribe knew everything needed to live, and there were huge trade networks as well for things that weren't locally available. You had people who were professionals, you had people who were specialists. And so when you lose those members of your society, you lose a lot, and you can't continue to live the older way anymore, and you have little choice. But often people think, oh, it all ended in the Spanish era, and that's not the case. Ohlone people continued to exist and continue to maintain aspects of culture and tribal identity, although for reasons of survival it had to go underground a bit through the Mexican land grant era. There's only three people of Ohlone heritage that I'm aware of out of the original 10 to 15,000 who ever were granted land as was ultimately promised back under the Mexican land grant system. They didn't have the kind of power that people in the dominant society had, and those lands were lost. But most of, that's the exception, right? But it's worth talking about exceptions. But the norm was for Ohlones to become serf-like laborers on Mexican land grants. So the Mexican government would be starting in the 1820s and fully formed in the 1830s, okay? It begins, of course, with the Mexican Revolution in 1821. And then in 1850, California becomes a state, and the tremendous upheaval and change continues, and disruption, and in some cases those are relatively mild words compared to what people lived through. But there was a grand jury called for Contra Costa County in the late 1800s. I've seen the documents, and they were trying to figure out how to address the problem of Native children being kidnapped from as far away as Napa County and being brought to work as a labor force in Contra Costa County on lands. So this apprenticeship acts that were not made illegal until after the Civil War in the United States, so they existed from 1850 into the 1860s, and it was more than one act, basically said that any Native person who wasn't working could be taken before a judge and essentially have to work for a certain number of years or until a certain age for specific landowners. And that set up this whole system of kidnapping and enslaving Native people.
And we're talking about what age here? What age children?
All ages.
Five?
Even younger sometimes,
wow.
Right? Sometimes the parents would be killed. Sometimes the children would just be taken. But it was also internal to what was happening to tribal people down here as well.
We're going to end here today and begin with this aspect of California Native history next week and hear about the impact of the mission system, the loss of traditional lands, land grants, and then this apprenticeship program that Beverly just began to touch upon here. This was a program imposed upon Native people and quite frequently meant that people were kidnapped and actually pressed into labor. As I say, you can contact the Coyote Hills Regional Park if you want to learn more. In the meantime, the folks there are doing a great job of accurately researching Native people and traditions, and the surrounding land is spectacular for walking and for riding your bike. Now, as we go out, I want to tell our listeners that for the next 3 months, I'll be traveling and submitting programs from Southern Africa and the Middle East. Not sure how all this will work out, given the remoteness of some of the areas I'll visit, but I'll do my best to bring you news, stories, and people from these parts of the world and do what we do at Raising Sand Radio, that is, present in-depth, progressive views on topics and ideas vital to the well-being of all nations and people. So tune in as usual, or listen as usual, and download the shows as usual. Our website is raisingsandradio.org, or you can contact me directly at susan@raisingsandradio.org. Thanks for listening, and as usual, views and opinions are those of the hosts and guests, and not KZSU or Stanford University.